Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the one and only Neil Jordan on his new memoir, Amnesiac. One of the most exciting young actors working in Ireland today, Aina Hardwick, on his new Cain and Abel drama, The Sparrow, as well as playing Paul Mescal's best friend in Normal People. And Chris Wasser is here with all the week's new movies. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. And I appear to have been the only person in Ireland who wasn't at Taylor Swift, according to social media. But the reports were great, and she is a remarkable talent, I have to say. And we had toyed with bringing our soon-to-be 9-year-old. I'm not sure if she would have done the 3 hours. She said she wanted to, but I think we might give it another year or two. But it looked like a terrific gig. I also couldn't get tickets at a price that, you know, didn't involve me selling my car. But anyway, to those of you who were there, it certainly looked great. I was away from all of that, though. I was in the hills of Donegal, having a mighty fine time, too. Anyway, enough of my travel log. You're here for TV and movie stuff. And this week in TV, I was watching this.
Most of them I write myself and post my own reviews online under pseudonyms, because how else am I going to get a good review?
Your Beautiful had gone to number one in America.
It hit.
His name became a rhyming slang.
Paul Weller had said he'd rather eat his own shit than work with me.
He's massive now, so he's got to tear him down.
I went through lonely moments of dealing with that.
So that was when he started doing his own tweets.
If someone's just going to come up and punch you, you might as well just punch yourself first.
Yes, the unmistakable sound, the speaking voice at least, of James Blunt. This is a new documentary on Netflix. It was out last year. It got a small cinema release, certainly in the UK, but it hit Netflix in the last couple of weeks. It's James Blunt, One Brit Wonder. Good title. And it involves him kind of on a comeback tour that was postponed due to COVID. And it's a documentary about his life and times, and in particular how in 2005 he went interstellar with You're Beautiful and that whole album, Back to Bedlam, that it was from, and then how the world turned against him, and as you heard there, his name became a very unfortunate rhyming slang. And in this, you see how all that worked out and how in a way he turned the critics on his head by taking the mickey out of himself. It's a nice story in some ways and a good showbiz tale about how he's become, certainly in England, somewhat of a national treasure because he learned to laugh at himself. And you feel very sorry for him in this at times because the vitriol was vitriolic. That's a tautology to say the vitriol was vitriolic. But it was really hard on him. What I found interesting about this, he was in the army famously, and he's a whole army background. His parents are very cold, and they sent him off to boarding school at the age of 8, and they're in this, and he loves them, and they love him, but they are very cliched, reserved British parents, stiff upper lip stuff. And it clearly seems to have molded his life, as I guess all parents mold the lives of their children. But look, this is an interesting watch. It's 90 minutes. You know, I'm not the greatest fan of James Blunt's music. It sounds at times like he's not either. But he comes across as charming, sometimes unusual company who's able to laugh at himself. So it's an interesting watch. And it turns out Ed Sheeran was a massive fan and kind of gives him a lot of credence for starting his own career. So One Brit Wonder on Netflix. It's a good watch. Let me know what you might have been watching this week. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, Neil Jordan is one of Ireland's best-known film directors, not to mention an equally prolific career as a novelist. He's just released his new memoir, intriguingly titled Amnesiac, where he takes us through his life and times in various, let's call them snapshots of various points in his life. It's a terrific read, and I'm delighted to say Neil joins me now. Neil, hello, sir. How are you?
No, how are you? I'm very good. Yeah.
So what I liked about this was, And maybe it's a very obvious place to start, but you know, this isn't my name is Neil, I was born in blah, blah, then I made The Crying Game. Like, it's very much a memoir, and even more that a kind of scattergun of your life. Were you very keen that if you were going to write about your life, that it wouldn't be that traditional beginning, middle and end?
Well, I mean, it can get very dull, can't it? I mean, I think celebrity is dull in and of itself, don't you? You know, and you know, when somebody says, and then I did this, and then I did that, and then I met the president of Ukraine or whatever, you know, or the president of Ireland, or, you know, it goes on like that. I think it can become a bit, I didn't even know if I wanted to write a memoir. I was asked by my publisher, and I just began with the first chapter about driving my mother up to the place we used to go on holidays as kids. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And I just kept going, really, you know. And I didn't want to do a recitation of all the different things I'd done. I mean, I didn't write much about the writing, but I it was important to me in a strange way to bring the personal aspects of the films as I remember them, you know, and integrate them with, you know, familial memories and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, no, it's beautifully tied together. And one thing I was really taken about was, you know, you write often, this happened kind of, and then it was, well, at least I think that was it. And a couple of times you say, I can't actually remember. And, you know, an editor might go, well, why don't you check and find out? But is this you kind of, you know, almost saying, look, I'm an unreliable narrator in my own life. This is the illusion of memory. This is what I think happened, but let's see where it goes.
I think everybody is. And I think in particular with your childhood memories, it's very difficult to separate what you've been told from what you actually observed yourself, you know. And if you look at photographs of when you were a kid or landscapes you saw when you were a kid, or in my case, my mother was a painter. So she painted most things I remember, and I find it very difficult to separate my memory from, you know, from what I have actually accidentally seen on the way through life, you know. And I think most of us don't know what we're about, you know. And it was really interesting when this book came out in relation to one movie I made, The Crying Game, you know. About 10 different people have different memories of when I told them what I was going to do with that script, you know? And it is really strange because I know myself, you know, when I conceived of the story and all that sort of stuff. But other people tell me, oh, you told me this in Berlin. You told me this in somebody's apartment. You told me this during a party, you know, that kind of thing. And so everybody's memory is different, and they're utterly selective, you know, totally. And they're often very kind of self-aggrandizing memories, aren't they, you know?
They certainly are.
Put yourself at the center of great events, you know, like Zelig.
Yeah.
In fact, you were just tangential to things that happened, really, you know?
And just let me ask you a couple of things that happened to you, even outside of the movies. Like, I was very taken, and I have no desire to upset you or anything, but you talked about your love of a particular train bridge not far from where you grew up, and how, you know, you've used it in your movies and stuff, and you muse on your father's passing, and you were away at the time, but what I got, and I'm just making sure I've read this correctly, is that he was having a heart attack, but yet he was with your daughter, and he managed to get her to the side of the river that he was fishing on before he kind of succumbed to the heart attack.
They were on a boat. They were
on a boat, right.
Boat, yeah, I think, and they were fishing, and he felt something was happening, so he got them to the shore, and then he died. I wasn't there, but that's what my daughter told me, my daughter Sarah, yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, you know, I suppose maybe he just felt an illness, and maybe, I'm sure he didn't know he was dying, but he just felt he didn't feel he was well. And then something else happened when they all got to the shore. That's the story I have been told. Now, maybe my daughter's memory is uncertain, maybe as well, you know, but I wasn't there.
Yeah.
That bridge, it's gone now, but it was really particular because there was a tiny little river around Lake Town, and the bridge took the Drogheda to Dublin train over it, but it also had a tiny little walkway running alongside it, you know? So if you want to cross from one side of the river to the other, you could take this little wooden walkway, and the, you know, the trains would thunder overhead. And for some reason, there were several times when I was making movies that I was stuck for a location, and I've used that bridge, and it's kind of very strange. You know, I used it I shot from it in Angel, the first movie I made. The opening shot of The Crying Game is the camera is tracking along the little walkway underneath the bridge. And I used it in Michael Collins, and I don't know, maybe that there are three instances where I've used it. And to me, the reason I wrote about that was because, you know, when I'm making those movies, they're all so different, and they're all about different things, they're about different issues, but, you know, there's this odd, strange personal thread that runs through them, you know, that
yeah,
it's entirely private to me, but I thought I'd write about it because it's true.
Yeah, and I remember particularly the scene with Stephen Ray and Michael Collins under that bridge, and it's beautifully raw to Michael Collins. At certain points during the book, you mention about, you know, this isn't a misery memoir. You know, I put it out there, I wasn't sexually abused, and I had a reasonably happy childhood and all that. But you do write about this, and it's almost Dickensian, let's call it an interaction with, you know, a possible paedophile who seems to be stalking you for years from St. Anne's Park. But I call it Dickensian because the way you write about it, he's literally in the hedges. And then a few years later, he sits beside you on a bus. I mean, did that stay with you all your life?
Not really. It's just when I began to write, you know, I began to write about, from the age of 12 or 13, you know, I was never that into soccer. You know, all the people started talking about football began to bore me to tears. You know, so I always had a girlfriend. You know, and you know, these relationships are quite important to you at a young age. But the girlfriends kept changing. You know, so there was 12. You know, I'd be going out with one girl when I was 14. I was remembering all that. I was thinking, okay, well, the most persistent presence during these years was this weird guy who used to follow. And I suppose it's not funny, but to me it was kind of emblematic of the strangeness of the time, you know? And this gentleman used to pop up in my life every 3 or 4 weeks. And he did it consistently, even up to the age of when I was about 17 or 18, you know? And I thought, okay, I don't know who this gentleman was, but he was a paedophile without a doubt, you know?
Yeah.
And his pursuit was kind of relentless, but he never got close to me, really. So I was spared that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you, some of the, you know, you didn't want to go into it kind of shows busy anecdote, as you said at the start, but some of the things you reveal about the movies are fascinating. And I thought I knew a bit about your career, but The Crying Game, which you've already referenced, like there was a deal in place where, because it was very successful, where crew and actors and the people who made it were going to take a share in the profits. And then a man called Weinstein rescinded that agreement. You're still rightly very angry about that, is my sense from what I read.
Yeah, it's not that. It's really, you know, if you make an independent movie, very often to get to the point where you can start shooting, you know, people have to, they have to defer their fees, it's called, you know. You get paid a minimum, you know, but yet you'll profit in the, you'll participate in the profit if the movie makes any money. And we made that movie in that way. And when it began to become successful in America, the Weinstein Company, Harvey and Bob together, they said they needed to spend a considerable amount of money to release it, you know, in 2,000 cinemas or right across the United States or whatever it was. So they came to the producers and they said, look, we need to rescind all these agreements. We need to have this profit possibility to borrow the money from a bank, and blah, blah, blah. Something like that. You know, so everybody was kind of, their participation in the American release of the movie was curtailed, really. And that really annoyed me, you know, and it really, I felt it was dishonest and unfair, you know.
Yeah.
Felt it at the time, and I said that to everybody at the time, but because, you know, Harvey at the time was a ticket to independent movies kind of success in the United States, nobody wanted to take it up with him, but I felt it very strongly, and that's why I wrote about it, you know. I don't want to, but it was it kind of it shocked me at the time, let me put it that way.
Rightly so. There's a great couple of chapters in the book, and they're very small, when you write about movies I never made. And I thought that was, it was a really interesting insight. But I suppose the one, and maybe lots of people mentioned this to you, Marlon Brando and the possibility of King Lear. When you go to meet him about that, it's fascinating because he's in that phase of his life where it seems maybe he didn't care so much. His weight was somewhat out of control. But your meeting sounds fascinating. I mean,
even more fascinating is the point is that he almost was King Lear, because I think there was a tragic kind of death amongst his siblings. You know, I think somebody had been killed that was related to, or his son or son-in-law. There was something went on like that. So there was a Lear-like aspect to Brando himself at the time, you know. You know, King Lear, he gives away his kingdom.
Of course.
All his daughters, and, you know, one by one, they kind of take control over what they said they would share with him and all that. So, you know, and so when I went to see Marlon to talk about this, and I did want him to play King Lear, I would have loved if he'd done it. I saw a king in isolation in a strange way. He used to live in this mansion at the top of Mulholland Boulevard, you know. And, you know, you'd drive up there and this legend would be there. And after an hour or so conversation, you realize you're talking to quite a lonely human being who didn't want you to go, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know? Isolation of extreme fame as well, I think, you know.
Yeah. And but you were also quite taken back. He seemed to be able to do Shakespeare and repeat every English actor who'd ever done it. Like, there was a lot in his head in terms of he knew.
I've never spoken to anybody about acting I've never had the same illuminating conversation about acting with anybody else. You know, the first thing he said to me is, no American actor can play Shakespeare, you know. And I said, but you did. And he said, what did I do? I said, well, in Julius Caesar. He said, I didn't play Julius Caesar. He said, you don't remember. He said, I played Mark Antony. I went, okay, fine, but, you know. And then he proceeded to imitate all of the Shakespearean performances I had seen on film, you know. You know, Ralph Richardson to Paul Scofield, Laurence Olivier, and he just did it brilliantly. You know, his memory of the nuances and performance was so exact. I thought, okay, fine.
Yeah.
And so, of course, an American actor could have played Shakespeare, you know. And what I was trying to say to him was, if you did play Shakespeare, you'd jettison all that British theatrical kind of tradition and the inheritances, which always to me kind of, you know, puts filmed versions of Shakespeare into a kind of, into a school book somehow, you know?
Anyway,
he didn't want to do it. He wouldn't have been able to remember all the lines, that's the truth, you know?
Okay.
He wouldn't want to have memorized all the lines, you know?
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Listen, here's a little name drop for you. I interviewed Julia Roberts last year and I had my prerequisite 8 minutes. And I mentioned Michael Collins to her because I had been an extra in my misspent youth. And her face lit up in this 8-minute interview in a London hotel when I mentioned it. And I just was reading this morning about she wanted to do that from day one. And you say in the book, she said, I don't want to be paid for it.
She didn't get paid. No, I mean, you can imagine how much Julia Roberts would have gotten paid at the time, but she did it for what they call scale, which is, you know, I mean, it is being paid, but it's like
the
lowest possible kind of rate that a day player would get. But she did it for the love of the script, you know, and you know, she was probably far too glamorous and beautiful for the role, probably far too famous for the role, because the minute you put somebody like Julia into a movie like that, it kind of sticks out a little bit, doesn't it? But I thought she was marvelous and I thought she did a wonderful job. And I was so glad she did it. I'd love to work again. She's, you know, I think she's one of the few American actors of that era, actress, should I say, who has kind of grown into herself as she's gotten older, you know? And I think what I've seen her do lately has been marvelous, I think, you know?
En route to my final question, that's my way of saying I'm going to ask you two more things, but slightly related. Just some of those scenes in Michael Collins are filmed in Dublin. And I notice a recurring theme in the book. You're really quite annoyed by what they've done to Dublin. Yeah, is that fair to say, in terms of the landscape of it and what's left of the architecture?
Well, I mean, the thing about, if you look at whatever people think about Michael Collins, okay, you know, I know people say, oh, you got it wrong, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, or, you know, Eamon de Valera didn't kill Michael Collins. I didn't imply he killed Michael Collins.
No.
You know, you give a bad impression of de Valera, whatever. The thing is, it was a record. If you look at it now, it's a record of the city that existed then. Now, when was it made?
1994-95, wasn't it?
495, okay. And we're now 2024, okay? So that's 30 years, yeah? So yeah. The city council gave us, and the city, you know, the city itself gave us such access to the place when we were making that movie, and they were so generous with it. But so much of the Edwardian, the Georgian, the Victorian city still existed, you know, when we made that film. And I think two-thirds of what we shot, of the landscapes we shot during that film are probably gone now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just wonder why that is. You know, it's like there was a beautiful place there and it's gone, you know? I mean, yeah. I think Dublin's always been run by people who kind of can't stand the idea of a city for some reason, but that's my personal opinion. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to become an old fogey or anything like that, but there was this beautiful place and you just wonder, where did it go?
Let me ask you finally then, Neil, what are you doing next? Now, once this book is out of the way, is there a movie in the offing or another novel or a TV show or all of those things in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, you know, I keep writing. I'm trying to get a movie going of the last book I wrote called The Well of St. Nobody. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get financing for independent movies at the moment, as anybody who works in that world will tell you. It's far easier to get a TV show going for the streamers, you know.
But,
you know, if I did something like that, it would have to be interesting, you know. But I have several things I'm thinking about, you know.
Okay.
And I keep on writing anyway.
Good man. Well, listen, we will leave you back to muse on your future creations. The new memoir is Amnesiac. It's a terrific read. Neil, thanks a million.
Thank you very much.
The great Neil Jordan there, talking about all sorts of things, most of which are contained in his new Amnesiac, which is a great read. I wasn't just, you know, playing to the crowd. There are these short chapters about his life and particular moments in his life. And he, you know, he said he didn't want to write a celebrity memoir. So he gets straight in with his experiences on some movies, and it's fascinating stuff. It really is. And they're short, which I really like. So you can nearly dip in and out of it if you wanted to, although it does read well from beginning to end. So that is Amnesiac, available in all good bookshops or wherever you choose to buy your books. Up next, the week's new movie releases in the company of Chris Wasser. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Delighted to be joined now by film critic and arts journalist Chris Wasser to look at some of the week's new movie releases, both on the big screen and indeed on your streaming service. We're going to be talking about the latest Lily Gladstone movie. I think the first thing she's done since Killers of the Flower Moon, Fancy Dance. We are going to talk Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F, because obviously I spent a lot of time on it last week, but we want to give it the Chris Wasser treatment. So without further ado, Chris Wasser, hello, sir. How are you?
John, I'm very well. How are you?
Very well. So listen, Fancy Dance, it got a small cinema release and is now on Apple TV and is still in cinemas as well, but I guess most people will probably watch it on Apple TV. What's it all about?
Yeah, they might do, but it is getting a limited cinema release. And actually, it does deserve that. And Lily Gladstone, is going to be an awful lot of interest in her off the back of Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which I thought she was a standout performer of. But even
did
that,
you, I'm sorry to go down a rabbit hole. Do you think she deserved Best Actress?
It's an interesting one. I know there's been an awful lot of conversation about whether or not that it was a sort of a supporting role or a lead role. I think it was a lead female role in the film. And obviously that's a decision. I think a lot of the time too, people watching the films, they forget that they're the that the actors and the studios have to put themselves forward for different categories. So that was, so a decision was made there to put her mm-hmm. forward for that category. And I think she definitely deserved that award. She was the beating heart of that film. You know, there's an awful lot of grandstanding going on from Leo, but I thought Lily Gladstone just, she's capable of stealing scenes with just a single glance. And that's a very special, you know, trait in an actor. That being said, she does get an awful lot more to do. You know, at least we get to hear an awful lot more from her in this story, which she's at the center of. She plays a woman named Jax, a Native American woman, a native of Oklahoma, Seneca Cayuga Nation Reservation. And she, when we first meet her, she is trying to kind of put aside this maybe career as a criminal and kind of start doing good by herself and also by her family, because she's a standing guardian for her teenage niece. Her name is Roki. She's 13. She's played by a brilliant newcomer, Isabel DeRoy Olsen. And basically, the child's mother is missing, John. And this, there's a long history of Indigenous women in America disappearing or, you know, being murdered and nothing being done about it. You know, that the authorities aren't interested, the FBI won't follow it up. And this is obviously, you know, a source of great frustration for Jax. So she's kind of leading this one woman, you know, hunt to try and find her sister. But whenever she kind of goes anywhere near the authorities, they're just more interested in who's raising the child and whether or not she's a suitable minder for Roki. So she has an awful lot to deal with there. And everything kind of goes sideways when Shea Whigham, wonderful character actor, he comes into the equation as her white father, Frank. And he's with a new partner and he starts asking questions, you know, about who's looking after my granddaughter, despite the fact that he was never really involved in the granddaughter's life or the other daughter's life. And as soon as he arrives, that's when everything just falls apart for Jax. You know, child protection services come knocking on the door. The kid is taken away. The only thing that Jax, the only way out of it for Jax, or at least she thinks, is to basically take Frank's car, take Roki, and hit the road. So it turns into this very complicated road trip film where Jax is essentially looking for her sister and looking for answers in all the wrong places.
Okay. Directed by a lady called Erica Tremblay, no relation to Joseph Tremblay of the Star of Room and things like that, the young star.
No, not at all. No. And also my first time seeing a film of hers, because I understand she is an experienced documentary maker, but this is actually her feature debut. And sometimes, you know, that shift from documentary to feature, it can be a little bit creaky. And there are signs here that, you know, there may be more promising titles ahead in her feature filmmaking career. But I like this a lot. You know, at times it feels like an old fashioned sentimental TV movie. And I know it's going on to Apple TV, and I know a lot of people might say, well, Chris, it is a television movie, but you might know what I mean by that. You know, it's a tiny little bit, you know, too melodramatic around the edges, people kind of explaining the plot a little bit too much. Silences would have worked more than, you know, additional dialogue. But Lily Gladstone really is terrific here, because it's a huge story. It might seem like a simple one, but it is essentially a story about, you know, the criminal mistreatment of Indigenous women in contemporary America. And we're seeing that in quite a lot of media, actually. Well, I say quite a lot, but maybe if you're looking at the last 10 years, a handful of films and television shows really isn't a lot. You know, they had it was in there was parts of it in True Detective. We saw a little bit of it in Wind River and some other Taylor Sheridan stuff. Here it's actually quite subtle. You know, Jax's story and all a lot of stuff about her past, like that kind of takes center stage, but there's an awful lot going on in the background. So it is accomplished. I think the whole thing kind of hangs on Lily Gladstone's performance. She is just brilliant here. And I said that thing at the top about her being able to steal a scene with a single look. She's doing that with, you know, with wonderful character actors like Shea Whigham, and that's usually his trait, John. But she's completely upstaging him. So I thought she was terrific here. Were you a fan of her in Killers of the Flower Moon?
I thought she was absolutely terrific, and I think she was more deserving than Emma Stone. There, I said it. But
yeah, there you go.
It's out there. And tell me this, you know, obviously, rightly containing big issues about, you know, the treatment of ethnic women and the lack of concern about their disappearance. But just to play devil's advocate, I mean, is that stuff whacking you over the head in this, or is it subtly?
Yeah, there are times when maybe some films like this can get a little didactic, and sometimes it's a little bit heavy handed. But it also remembers that this is a story about, you know, an aunt and her niece. And we kind of explore Jax's past a little bit. We understand that, you know, at one point she was a drug dealer and that things didn't really work out for her, but that she is trying really hard. And I should say she's trying really hard, but she's also taught Roki how to be a skillful thief. But that actually sets us up for, you know, on one side, provide some anxiety-inducing scenes where Rocky is actually stealing things for the first time, but also like a little bit of a funny, you know, bond between the two of them. So their story is front and center, and the reason it's called Fancy Dance too is because Rocky really believes, you know, she's 13, but there's still, she's just hanging on to that little bit of childhood innocence where she doesn't really know about, you know, the countless other indigenous women who have disappeared in the area, and indeed other reservations, and that nothing's been done about it. She really does think, because her mom has a habit of disappearing before, or basically just going off for a long weekend and then coming back, that she'll be back. And she and she has promised her daughter that she will take her to something called a powwow, which is basically a sort of native dance and a festival coming up where Native Americans are invited to perform music, to dance. The whole thing is kind of loosely choreographed. It's more about, you know, families coming together, and it's more of a kind of a coming of age experience, especially for kids like Rocky. So she is just constantly looking forward to this dance. And it doesn't matter how far they get away from home, or the fact that you have the FBI chasing Jax, you have the cops chasing Jax. There's this wonderful innocence about it. When wherever we follow Rocky, she just thinks that she's on her way to the ceremony. So stuff like that works extraordinarily well. You know, the commentary around it can be a little bit creaky at times, and also quite predictable. I mean, you know, even if you're just listening to this review and you haven't seen the film yet, you'll probably know that there's only one way that this tale, unfortunately, can end for Jax, especially if she has the FBI after her. But I thought that the filmmaker, Erica Tremblay, she does well to kind of take this predictable story and turn it into something sensitive, soulful, profound, and poignant. So it is quite impressive for a first film.
So what would you say stars-wise for Fancy Dance?
I think a solid 3. We're talking about maybe a 4 or 5 star lead performance in a 3-star film.
Okay.
So basically, John, I'm looking forward to seeing more from Lily Gladstone, because she is the real deal.
Yeah, absolutely she is. Well, let's take a quick clip of Fancy Dance.
Afternoon, ladies. What can I get started for you?
I'll take a coffee, black, and a ham and cheese omelet.
There's so much good stuff.
You can have whatever you want.
Really?
Really.
Okay, I'll take the strawberry pancakes, the strawberry waffles, the strawberry blintzes, and whatever that one is.
Strawberry crepes?
Yeah, strawberry crepes.
All right.
Oh, and do you have anything like cake or pie or dessert or something for when you're celebrating a big event?
Oh, is it your birthday?
No, it's for my period.
Oh, well, I ain't never celebrated that a day in my life, but I'll see what I can do.
That's a clip of Fancy Dance, which is in select cinemas and also available to stream on Apple TV, starring, of course, the great Lily Gladstone. Well, I've seen her in one thing, and I thought she was great in it, so I'm happy to call her that. Chris Wasser gave it 3 stars. Now, last week, I spent a lot of time talking about Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F. It wasn't out, but it is out as of this Wednesday, the 3rd of July. I really liked it. I'm a child of the 80s. I was also interviewing Eddie Murphy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Kevin Bacon. So I was in a very much Beverly Hills Cop state of mind. But now that the fog is lifted, we better ask Chris Wasser what he made of Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, because it is out on the 3rd of July, as I say. Well, Chris, over to you.
Well, I can't compete with that sort of name dropping. I remember a couple of weeks ago on the show, I mentioned Austin Butler's name, but you just hit me with 3 legendary performers there.
If you can get up, continue, you know.
Look, I've said to you before that I don't think I was nowhere near the top of the queue when it came to people lining up for another Beverly Hills Cop film. You know, I thought, like, look, the first one was a lot of fun. Watched it originally when I was a kid. The second one still kind of retained that charm. The third one, I've forgotten all about it. And actually, there is a lovely, you know, throwaway but kind of important line that references the third film in this one, to kind of acknowledge, look, we don't really know what we were doing there. And look, I'm totally behind this idea of getting Eddie Murphy back on our screens again. I know he's off telling everyone that he's been recording lines for another Shrek film, for another Donkey film. I'm sure that'll be fun, but I want Eddie Murphy front and center in a live action film that has nothing to do with Christmas, that has nothing to do with him playing, you know, 7 different roles at once, that has nothing to do with, you know, turning a Disney theme park ride into a film. Just give us an Eddie Murphy story. And if this is the way to get Eddie Murphy back on our screens, then so be it. In terms of plot, John, I must say I spent about 2 hours, you know, kind of just every now and then going, what's this about? You know, it's essentially crooked cops Axel Foley having a grown-up daughter, Jane, who's now a lawyer in Beverly Hills. He's obviously stuck in Detroit. He's obviously made some mistakes in his personal life and devoted far too many years, far too many decades to the job. And he's at a point where, you know, even his captain is retiring, and there is that, you know, all-important speech from the captain saying, you know, Axel, there's more to life than this. And that actually coincides with a panic phone call from his old friend, Billy Rosewood, to say that he's actually been looking into some dodgy cop business for Jane, who, as I said, is a lawyer now. And they've both landed themselves in trouble because they're a little bit too close to a beast or to a bear that they shouldn't have poked. So Axel, thinking that his daughter, who he hasn't seen in years, is in trouble, he boards the first plane to Los Angeles and ends up back in Beverly Hills, back to his old stomping ground, and back to kind of, you know, up to his usual troublemaking. Although this time, instead of the sort of buddy cop sort of thing, I suppose it is a buddy cop thing, but it's more of a father and daughter quest this time.
Yeah. Now, I agree with you. The plot, you know, it's thin enough. But I think if you go back to the first one, it was also quite thin. But what I liked about this, it kept the beats of the first one. I felt that it was very honest to it, and yet it was updated. And I thought Murphy was back to his near best as Axel left. Like, at one point, they steal a snowplow, and I was genuinely belly laughing. I also really liked the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character, because he's kind of his reluctant partner for half of this, and I thought that worked well. And I thought the Easter eggs to Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2 essentially worked really well, like where he goes into a hotel and he's about to do a special, go into some impersonation, he goes, oh, you know what, I'll just buy the room. Like, I thought it all worked, and it gave me a smile. I'm sensing you're not there as much as I was, though.
I thought Eddie Murphy was great in it. As I said, any excuse to see him back on screen, and he is a hoot. And I strongly suspect that some of his best lines in this film, John, were improvised.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because, well, you know, Eddie Murphy has been known to do that, and he's very, very quick. You know, obviously as a stand-up comic, but also as an actor, you know, he brings some magic that wasn't there on the page. And the reason why I think he was improvising was because no one else gets nearly, like, everyone else's lines aren't nearly as sharp as his. So he's having a blast here. You know, he's a little bit slower on his feet, but he's in great nick. You know, he looks terrific. The comic timing, there's nothing wrong with it. He is having fun. That sort of fun is infectious. It's just the film around him feels a little bit forced. And I was saying to you before, it's almost like, and we're getting a lot of these kind of, you know, I'm going to say it, legacy sequels and you know, late in the day add-ons to beloved franchises that just feel a little bit like going to see your favorite band who got back together and they're finally on stage together, but when they start playing, the instruments are out of tune. And I know that's a creaky analogy, but that's sort of how it feels when you're watching this. And I do appreciate that a good bit of effort has gone into making this actually look like a film, because when people hear that it's on Netflix, they might kind of go, oh, it's that kind of glossy, you know, CG instead of practical effects. You know, everything is just too kind of baked in sunshine. It's far too fake and digital. No, they're you know, the sequences here, however messy, a lot of them are practical, and I did appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But the performances, I thought Taylor Page actually was especially good as the daughter. I thought Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he kind of walks that fine line between looking as though he's not really interested in the material, and then in the next scene, you know, wow, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is giving it everything here, trying to land this helicopter. You know, he's really selling this for me. So it kind of, I'm probably not making an awful lot of sense here, but I kind of fell in and out of love with this film as I was watching it. I was thinking, great to have Murphy back. Oh, the story is barely there. Oh, look, Kevin Bacon's in it. Oh, but Kevin Bacon's character isn't really worth the puns here. It was far too wobbly for me.
Okay, fair enough. What would you say stars-wise for Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F?
We will go with 2.5. Do you know what? I mentioned Kevin Bacon there. Do you know what would have been nice, John? If the film had at least tried to convince us at first that Kevin Bacon wasn't playing the bad guy. Because he's straight in there. There's no guessing. It's just like Kevin Bacon. He's the bad guy. What's the mystery's over. Like, that's, you know, and I think a little bit more effort should have gone into that. Look, if Eddie Murphy had a laugh and if he wants to do another one, so be it. But it all felt a little bit forced to me.
Okay, fair enough. You see, for someone who was adoring of those movies in the 80s, I was pleasantly surprised by how not bad it was and how pleasant the times it was. But listen, I get what you're saying, but it's probably a solid 3 stars for me because I smiled a lot through it. But anyway, you're more important in this grand scheme of things. We are nearly out of time, but just in a minute, I was talking to Aina Hardwick, one of the co-stars or one of the stars of the new Irish movie, The Sparrow. I know you've seen it as well, Chris. What did you make of it?
I thought it was a solid feature debut for Michael Killarnes. Reminded me of some of the earlier work of Lenny Abramson, which is no bad thing. And it's a funny one to talk about because if you say too little about the plot, I don't think people might kind of, I don't know whether people will flock to it, but if you say too much, you risk spoiling what is an unsettling and quite unique premise. It's an unusual film. So all I will say is that, despite some flaws, Michael Killarnes shows that he is a promising filmmaker. This film shows that we have a very promising up-and-comer by the name of Ollie West, who's obviously the in the lead role as Kevin Coyle, the troubled teenager of the piece. It's beautifully shot. It's neatly performed. And it's always worth it to see Aina Hardwick at play because I do think he is one of the most extraordinary young actors we have at the minute. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing where he goes next.
Here. Well, that is a good review for The Sparrow, an unforgiving 2.5 for Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, and 3 stars, a solid 3 stars for Fancy Dance. Chris, lovely to talk to you.
And you, John. Thanks a million.
Up next, the aforementioned Aina Hardwick on his new movie, The Sparrow. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now there's a great new Irish movie in cinemas this Friday, the 5th of July. In Sparrow, Ollie West plays Kevin, a sensitive, moody teenager with chipped black nail varnish. He's constantly in trouble and he's nothing like his army veteran dad or his popular big brother Robbie, played by Aina Hardwick, whose easy smile wins him the girl that they both like. Kevin feels like an outsider in his family and it doesn't help that he reminds people of his sadly passed mother. The family's already bewildered in grief when something pretty horrific happens and plunges the family into a maelstrom. I don't want to say much more than that because there are some dark secrets at the heart of this. It was directed by Michael Killarnes and stars newcomer Ollie West as Kevin, as I mentioned, but it also stars Aina Hardwick as the brother. Now, I've been dying to talk to Aina because he's BAFTA nominated for his role in The Great Sixth Commandment. He gave a brilliant performance in Lakelands that we spoke about earlier in the year. And if we want to go back, there is, of course, his famous role as Connell's friend in Normal People. I was going to say he's an up-and-coming actor, but he's very much arrived, and in fact he's arrived in the building. Aina, how are you, sir?
Great, John, thanks for having me.
It's West Cork where you hail from. Well, you're certainly from Cork is my understanding. And how can you not be from that accent? But yet, West Cork and Cork is beautiful a lot of the times, and it is beautiful, but on screen it's beautiful, but it's kind of haunting in this movie. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. It's a place that's a big landscape in my own life, and a place I always thought would be very cinematic and would be a great backdrop. But I think the beauty of West Cork is a kind of a, there's a dark beauty to it as well, and there's the stunning kind of vistas and being there on the Atlantic in that bracing wind, it's a dramatic landscape.
Yeah.
And I think any film that's sort of telling a story there, that landscape is going to shape it to a degree. And I know Michael conceived of this when he wasn't living in West Cork, when he was in Dublin. And the story then got sort of morphed and shaped by moving down to Baltimore, which is a beautiful seaside town.
Yeah.
For me, I read it and thought this is such a strong West Cork identity, and I couldn't put my finger on why, because I think it's very hard to put your finger on something like a location or an atmosphere, but it just really felt like a West Cork story, and that was something I'd always been, hoping I'd get to do.
Yeah, and it's funny, it's almost a location like that demands to be a character in the film or something like that, which it is this, Let me ask you about your character, the kind of happy-go-lucky brother of sorts, but he's dealing with the grief of the loss of the mother in a different way than Kevin is. That must have been an interesting kind of thing as an actor, that you have these, I don't want to say Cain and Abel, but two brothers looking at a tragedy in very different ways. They're either side of it.
Yeah, it's this, without going too much into the story. It's a story of grief,
I'm
for sure.
I'm mindful of that. Because there are moments in this where the movie changes. But
definitely fair to say it's a story about grief, I think, and how young men deal with grief. I mean, it's a very masculine household. So there's Sally, our younger sister, but, you know, she's definitely shaped by this very masculine household. And I think it's a very nuanced portrait about how these young men cope with grief in their own ways. And I suppose for Robbie, he does have that attitude of plow on, you know, don't let this sort of define you, and kind of use it as a sort of spring or a kind of something to propel you on. It's a very kind of, I guess, maybe traditionally old-fashioned kind of masculine way of approaching it. But then it's not just that. That's the great thing about these characters. It's far more nuanced than that. And I suppose Kevin is, quote-unquote, the black sheep of the family. He's also, you know, they're both sharing this grief. Robbie, who I play, and Kevin, who Ollie West plays, they're both sharing this grief. And there are moments when they can discuss it and be open with each other. So I was really taken with that portrait of fraternal kind of relationship, because it wasn't one dimensional. Yeah. There are scenes where we are able to kind of share our grief, and I suppose talk about the kind of the conflicted and tricky character that our father is, played by David O'Hara. And then there are scenes where it's far more cutthroat and kind of brutal and cruel.
Yeah.
And I loved getting into that, because there was so much of the brothers' relationships that I could sort of identify with and figure out, because I've got four brothers myself, and I think there were patterns in those that were very clear to me. But then there were edges to the script that were totally sort of shocking to me. Yeah. And Michael was really strong on getting those across, like this kind of ritualistic sort of old-fashioned, you know, military grade discipline that goes through the house. Those were all sort of sharp edges to these characters, and I think Michael was keen to make sure they were there.
You're too young a man to suggest that you're being pigeonholed or anything like that, but I'm just conscious of the fact that in Lakelands, which you were brilliant in, you play this guy who seems to have it all and then suffers a head injury. In this, you're quite a popular guy. In Normal People, where you played Rob, if that was your character's name, if I'm not mistaken. But yet, all three characters, as you've said, there are dark edges. Have you been cognizant or conscious of the fact that there's a through line through some of these characters?
I think they're all young men of the same generation in Ireland, and from like very different places. Like Lakelands is a film set in the Midlands.
Yeah.
This is a Cork film. Normal People, I suppose, was a West of Ireland story and a kind of coming to Dublin, coming to university story. And so all of them definitely, you know, I could find loads to identify with. Mm. But they're all just, it's great writing and they're great characters. And I see what you mean. I think there's a thread through those characters. I think there are commonalities. It's a small island. I think there are commonalities that like shared by all of them. And I guess a big one is probably that sense of having to move past a place, you know, having to get away from the, you know, if you're in a rural town or village, the sense that maybe you need to sort of get out of there to, I don't know, find something else in your own life. And to some extent, all those characters probably, that was something that confronted them, you know. And in Lakelands, it was actually about someone who loved where they were from and wanted to stay there and rejected these pressures of like, well, you better move on now. Whereas Robbie, I guess, is bursting to embrace the world and get out of home. And yeah, I don't know why. Maybe that's true of any young person, but it seems to be a question we're always posed in Ireland, you know.
Yeah, probably more than anywhere else.
Probably more than anywhere else.
Listen, I made reference to BAFTA nominee for the brilliant The Sixth Commandment, which you know, if people don't know, it's a great watch, and I think it's still on the BBC Player, which we can't access in Ireland, but let's not get into that. And it's about a horrific case, and you play Ben, who was very manipulative in that. But, you know, and I would urge people to watch that, and it's a great performance. But on the lighter side of it, I mean, BAFTA nominations, I know, you know, Robin Williams says awards are nice, they hold the mail, but still, it must be great to get nominated for a BAFTA.
It was an amazing day when that nomination came through, and a great few weeks afterwards. I think the main thing is just to be in that company. As it happened, I had seen, I think, almost all of the shows that were in that category, and then watched them all over the subsequent weeks. And it's really strange, surreal, but lovely thing to see yourself in that company. The cliche holds, like, it is just nice to be there and nominated. And after that, I didn't really think twice. But I was really, I guess, those things count for more when you really are proud of the project. And I was so proud to be part of this storytelling. I thought that the way Saul Dibb, and who directed it, and Sarah Phelps, who wrote it, I thought the way that they constructed it and told the story was really unique and not something I had sort of seen. Mm. So first and foremost, I was just delighted to see the recognition for them and for Tim Spall and Anne Reid. It was, a very special thing to be part of.
You've probably never done an interview where normal people doesn't come up, and this will be no exception, yeah, I'm afraid. But like, it's now COVID, you lose a sense of it, but it's nearly 4 years at this stage. But was that very life-changing a thing for you? Forget about the plaudits, yeah, and how important it was for people to watch it during lockdown, and how great a show it was and how great the book is. But what, I don't know, do you see your life as maybe a before and after in terms of acting with that?
Yeah, probably. I think, I just think it was such an incredible story for, you know, whatever about us as actors getting to do it. But I was so proud of what that story did. It was the novel, first and foremost, was a contemporary Irish novel that, you know, talked about the way we live and communicate and the way we love and all of those things in this present moment. So when I was reading it, I couldn't believe it. You know, I hadn't read a book that spoke so much to, I thought, this very particular time we were living in, yeah, not only in Ireland, but all over the world, but yeah, very specific to Ireland as well. So when that expanded to a TV show, and I heard that, you know, Element were doing it, and Sally was going to adapt the scripts with Alice Birch, and Element were doing it, and all these great, great people, it felt like, oh, maybe we haven't had a TV show that sort of tells this side of Ireland, or yeah, this kind of side of modern Ireland. So that was, for me, that was the most special thing, yeah, was that then went international, and if that felt like a kind of a new ground or something, yeah, you know. Yeah. And then as a part, it was a part that was really dear to me and I cared about, and the experience of filming it was bizarre, because so many of us went to college together, and if we didn't go to college together, we knew each other from being around Dublin.
Yeah.
So it felt like, I don't know, it just felt like making something with your mates. And none of us really knew or had any expectations that it would go where it did.
And my understanding is that, you know, the character Rob, he's, like we talked about, this seemingly very popular guy. And then, yeah, you know, things get very hard from him. I gather people, you know, people stop you on the street, and you feel that it's really spoken to young men in some ways.
Yeah, I think it has. I was aware of that responsibility. I felt it, and I wanted to get it right, because it, you know, that storyline means a huge amount to me, as I guess it probably does to, you know, almost everyone in Ireland.
Yeah, and absolutely,
it's something that sadly we, you know, most of us have connections with or experience of. And I think whatever the context, seeing that reflected on screen or in storytelling is just a very cathartic thing. Mm. And that's, I think, why storytelling is a healthy thing to have in our lives, and a great thing to have in our lives. So it was brilliant. You know, I'm just really pleased and proud that people felt it was truthful, and people felt like they could identify with the story and that character, or people's, you know, friends of that character. Mm. And I felt very lucky to be allowed to tell that side of the story.
Yeah. And tell me this, the first thing I don't remember it at the time, but I certainly saw it, but reading back, was Eclipse with Colin McPherson. You were just a gossoon, as you might say back then. Did you often these times they're just, you do it and then maybe you never think about it again, but did you get the bug on that as a young boy when you did that?
Definitely. It was one of those completely out of nowhere kind of, you know, opportunities to make a film on my doorstep with Conor McPherson and Ciarán Hinds and Eben Yaila, Aidan Quinn, all these brilliant people, and Robin Rebecca, who produced that, I went on to work with years later. So that was something that gave me a bit of, it gave me the grow for it. And also, I was a kid. I didn't really know what I was doing. I probably wasn't very good. I definitely wasn't very good. But I think it was the buzz around the story, you know. Yeah. And I knew at the time, I was only like 11 or 12, but I knew the story was doing something unusual. For those who haven't seen the film, it's this really dark, kind of like haunting film that's also a love story that's set during a literary festival. It had all these odd components, and I remember thinking, do you know what, this is unusual, like this is cinema's cool, like this isn't what I've seen, you know, this isn't what I've been watching. And I was working with Ciarán Hinds, who's, you know, the nicest man in the industry. And
so did you go, I want to do this after that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was really annoying. I remember Rob and Rebecca kind of reminded me, they're like, you were asking 100 questions a day. And again, it wasn't the creative side of it, probably, because I was a kid and I was just kind of arriving and doing what I was told. But it was the feeling on set. It was the, like, we're all getting here at 6 in the morning and making this film together.
Yeah.
This feels like a great way to spend a day.
Well, the results are there, because Eclipse is a great movie, as is The Sparrow, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 5th of July. It is a great watch and an Irish watch. Not that that matters. It co-stars or stars Aina Hartwick. Aina, lovely to meet you in person.
Great to meet you, John. Thank you.
I'm not one for speeches.
Thank Christ for that.
Amen.
I just wanted to say that I'm really proud of you, son. Well done.
Yeah. Nice day. Thanks. Mum would have been proud too.
Well, she would have, Larry. Can we drink now?
Yes. To Robbie.
To Robbie!
To Robbie! To Robbie!
A clip there from The Sparrow. And you heard me talking to the very exciting actor, Aina Hartwick, who is already doing great things, but you feel is going on to more great things. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend, and I will talk to you all next week.